And now for something completely different.
It is that time again. It is time for Chat with a Cat. This Chat with a Cat episode is being recorded on the 5th of May, 2025. In the game world, this is after Sim 9 of Season 3. That's the 1982-83 season. We've just passed the trade deadline. We're getting ready to come down the stretch as far as playoffs are concerned. I think in both conferences, the top two or three teams are pretty clear. The bottom four playoff teams, you know, there's going to be seven teams fighting for six spots. So there's still a little bit of intrigue, but I think for the most part, we know how the playoffs are going to shake out. Last week, talked a little bit about trades. I mentioned I thought most of the trading was done. I wasn't quite correct. We still got five trades in as we got toward the trade deadline, so I thought I would go through those real quick. The first one, probably the biggest, is the trade between the Kings and the Mavericks. I noted last time I was a little bit surprised the Mavericks started selling off assets. They continued the sell-off by sending away Bernard King and Elvin Hayes for Bill Laimbeer, Jay Vincent, and 15 points. I'm assuming the reason a draft pick wasn't involved here is because the Kings are fresh out of draft picks. It's a trade that's clearly made with an eye to the future for the Mavericks. Elvin Hayes is a still good player, but is getting older. Bernard King is about to enter his prime as one of the top scorers in the league. In return, they're getting Bill Laimbeer, who took a hit in training camp, but is still a premier rebounder. I think he hasn't scored as much as perhaps the Kings would have liked, and that's probably why he became expendable. Jay Vincent is a young, up-and-coming piece, but I don't think he's any great shakes. How did the Mavericks do on this one? I think this was probably okay if they had just sent King. I think sending Hayes, they probably got a little bit of the worst end of the deal, but they may have figured they weren't going to be able to get anything else for Hayes before his age started eroding his skills, so they may have figured he was a throw-in. Obviously, the Mavericks are building for the future. The Kings are building for now. This gives the Kings, at least as of this writing, two of the top three scorers in the league, so it's pretty clear the Kings are going in all in on offense to try to make it through the playoff gauntlet this season. I'm not 100% sure that this is ideal simply because I think Laimbeer actually matched up decently defensively against the Warriors' pair of bigs, and to a lesser extent, in terms of what you have to worry about, the Trailblazers' pair of bigs, now that they have Roundfield, I thought Bill was a great way to neutralize folks, and paired with Mike Gminski, I thought that meant the Kings actually had the defensive chops to hold down some of the favorites' front courts, but obviously they felt they needed more scoring. Pairing King with Nat gives them an interesting scoring combo. The question I have is, where are the rebounds and defense going to come from? I'm going to assume Darth is going to say Elvin Hayes will handle the rebounding and defense. Maybe he's right. I guess we'll see. The proof is in the pudding. I think the Kings are equipped to get past one of the Trailblazers and the Warriors, but having them win two series against those teams is going to be rough. So we'll see how matchups roll. We know the playoffs tend to be about matchups. I mentioned that at my town hall about the Suns, Jazz, and Lakers matchups. So whether or not this turns out to be a great trade for the Kings remains to be seen. In the next trade, the Bulls and the Supersonics made a trade. The Bulls sent Robert Reed off to the Supersonics for the Sonics' 85 first-round pick and Keith Heron. Reed is a player with no super strengths, no horrible weaknesses either. And the 85 first from the Sonics, at least with the direction the team is going in now, looks pretty good. Keith Heron is probably a throw in for salary. I don't think I've seen much out of him in any of his seasons in the league. So this winds up being a move where the Bulls continue to sell off the present in exchange for future assets. It's probably a fair trade. Robert Reed was the last member of their team that was being shopped, and I don't know that they could have gotten much more than they did. This takes us to the Jazz and the Nuggets. This was put in as a trade that was going to be Peter Verhoeven for 3 points. However, it was invalidated because Verhoeven hasn't been with the Jazz for 60 days. Again, this goes back to if you're going to flip a player, you need to make sure that you get him in immediately following Sim 3. Waiting, pulling the trigger late after Sim 3 means you're stuck with him for the rest of the season. So there is just another reminder to watch your timing, you know, watch your cap space, things like that. The next trade that was posted was the Pacers and the Mavericks. This one was initially invalidated due to putting the Pacers over the salary cap, so it was reworked. In the reworked trade, the Mavericks sent Dan Issel, Johnny High, and Quinn Buckner in return for Jeff Huston, Mark Landsberger, Rudy Tomjanovich, Abdul Jilani, and 3 points. I have to think here this is basically dumping Dan Issel for points. If I'm not mistaken, Issel's an expiring contract. He's in his mid-30s, so this was probably what the Mavericks felt was their last chance to get value for him. For the Pacers, it's pretty obvious a bring-in of a high-scoring big for a playoff run. If it works out, great, and if not, you're not on the hook past this season. So I can see why both teams did this. A little surprised that Issel went for as little as he did. Everything else is salary filler. The last trade was the Bullets and Clippers, where the Clippers sent along Walter Davis, who they had picked up earlier in the season from the Bucks, for Rod Higgins and Brian Taylor. Rod Higgins is a young player with a lot of potential, isn't there yet. Brian Taylor is kind of an aging guard who's still good but is not part of future plans for the Clippers. Obviously, this season did not go as they had hoped. Walter Davis is a good player, but he's also, I think, 26. I'd have to double check real quick here. Let me just take a look. I'm going off memory here. 26, yeah. No, 28, my apologies. So he's in his prime. He's not going to be around when the Clippers finish any potential rebuild, so they probably thought, let's move off of him and get onto a younger asset in Rod Higgins. I think Higgins has some potential. I like that he's already averaging 15 points a game in his rookie season. He's averaging 30 minutes a game, so there's not a lot of room for his stats to grow based on adding game time. But if you look at his potentials, it looks like in scoring, he still has some room to grow. Everywhere else, he's probably close to maxed out. But as it is, he's certainly a solid piece, and he'll be cheap and under the Clippers' control for the foreseeable future. So I can see the attractiveness. Once you've decided that you're no longer going to be able to compete in the current season, and I think the Clippers waited till just about the last possible second here. This trade came in just before the deadline. I know the Clippers anticipated being able to compete this season. They gave the season enough time to play out, and that's one thing to be aware of is that sometimes teams can get off to a slow start. You need to give things time to play out. Generally, panicking after one or two sims is not a good move. It's rough, right? Because if you want to be able to change your mind and flip a player, you have to make the decision after the third sim to get in if you want to turn around and trade him again at the deadline. But really, it's hard to tell where your team is going until maybe five sims in. So you have to maybe make some early moves. And so finding that balance is sometimes hard. There's probably a podcast that I'll do in the future talking about ways you can analyze your team to see what's real and what's not. I know a few podcasts ago I talked about, you know, what's real and what's fake and how do you know. There are some statistical ways you can measure your team early to kind of see what's going on. And at some point, I'll probably want to take a chance to talk about those. But that completed the trades by and large. And so with that, I wanted to kind of move in after a very short break. There's not going to be any other fake commercials in this one. To move on to the the rookie draft preview, because I mentioned that I was going to have a fun time looking over that. And I think now is the time to look over it when nobody knows who's going to draft, because then I'm comparing players to players and not fit to fit on various teams, trying to get inside GM's head. So we'll be back in a minute or two with the draft preview, and I'll give you my thoughts on what I see. All right, as promised, that was a quick one. So coming back quickly to the draft preview, one of the things that I have noticed is that it seems like every draft kind of has its own theme. And if I were looking at the theme for the 1983 draft, it's kind of big and little and nothing in the middle, if that makes sense. If you take a look at the current draft class, all of the top prospects, be it the purple or blue level prospects, are shooting guards or point guards with one center in the person of Ralph Sampson. And then if you take a look behind that, you have two centers, Steve Stepanovich, Randy Brewer, I guess Thurl Bailey too, although I always think of Thurl Bailey as more of a small forward because that's where he played for the Utah Jazz in real life. And then you have kind of a mix. You have a couple of power forwards, couple of shooting guards, couple of small forwards, couple of point guards. But again, looking toward the top of this class, this is a guard-heavy draft class. And if you look back on the moves that defined this season from a trade point of view, the first move I think that defined the season was the Robert Parrish to the Warriors trade, wherein the Warriors got their Twin Towers lineup going. That was followed by Bill Laimbeer moving to the Kings, creating a Twin Towers. The Bullets made moves to acquire Buck Williams, Twin Towers. The Blazers made a move to acquire Down Roundfield, Twin Towers. Even some of the teams that are not as high in the playoff seedings went for Twin Towers. Look, you looked at the Lakers, they picked up Dave Corzine, hoping that he would be their answer at power forward. He wasn't, but you saw the attempt there, again, trying to get to Twin Towers. Even the Celtics, in their rookie pickups of Eaton and Lister, went Twin Towers. So what we're seeing is, I don't want to say a correction of that, but we've seen a lot of trades where teams are trying to get big. And any team that was looking to get big through the draft, unless you pick up Ralph Sampson, probably isn't getting that this year, simply because the other potential centers are still very raw offensively. And so you're not going to be getting instant help. In fact, if I were to say, you know, you've got a theme in this draft, it's raw. Clyde Drexler, Dale Ellis, both look amazing in potential. They're not there yet. We even see our first orange-blue in Sadale Threat, who is going to be an excellent option at some point, but it kind of is reminiscent of Sleepy Floyd this past season, where I mentioned I was concerned with A potentials and ratings in the 20s. How long is it going to take him to get to those ratings? So this draft class has a lot of players that are very raw, that are more perimeter-oriented, and that's probably a good thing considering how front-court-heavy the league is. But what that means is that I think it puts an inflated value on Ralph Sampson in the draft and maybe even brings up the value of some of the other centers and power forwards, because any team that is looking to start picking up pieces for a rebuild is going to value the more rare asset, and that is size, then it's going to value the plentiful asset, which in this case is guards, particularly point guards. I think I commented when the league first started that there were not a ton of great point guards in the creation draft. Obviously, at the very top end, Magic Johnson was terrific, but now we've had several point guards come in, Fat Lever's broken leg notwithstanding. You've got Fat Lever, you've got Sleepy Floyd, we had Isaiah Thomas in the first draft. Now you've got Sadale Threet, you've got Derek Harper, you've got Doc Rivers, you've got John Paxson, you've got John Sundvall, Darrell Walker, Mitchell Wiggins. So we're seeing this influx of very talented point guards coming into the league. And I think we've also got some very, very high-end shooting guards. You've got Byron Scott and Jeff Malone, who both look like they're ready to plug and play right now at the shooting guard spot. You've got Craig Elo, Dale Ellis, and Clyde Drexler. I think Drexler and Ellis are the two obvious picks just due to the potential. Their offense may be a little bit raw, but add a smidgen of training and very, very quickly they're going to be getting up there. And most of the teams that have been tanking this season have been accumulating points as part of their deals. So they will have the ability to accelerate the training for these rookies. And that is something that I think is, I don't want to say new, but let's say a different experience, wherein with the creation draft, a lot of the players came fully formed and ready to go. And now that we're getting into drafts, we're seeing players with excellent potentials, but that are very, very raw. And so we're going to take time to grow into those potentials. So teams are valuing points so that they can accelerate that growth process. So where points might have been seen as kind of a throw-in or something that you greased the wheels to get a trade done and didn't really worry about them, I think GMs that have been mindful of where they are point-wise are going to be able to get more value out of draft picks a little more quickly than teams that are not in that boat. If I'm looking at the draft, obviously Drexler is probably the number one overall pick. Number one, he's 2 years younger than Ellis, but also his potentials are just through the roof. He's got a few C's, mostly B's and A's. He has A's in the defensive categories you want, in the scoring categories you want, and that's going to make him the prize, basically, for which everybody is competing. Now, Ellis also has A ratings in all of his offensive stats, but he only has C's and D's in the defensive stats. So there's your difference. Is Ellis is going to be a fantastic one-way player, whereas Drexler is going to be the better two-way player, at least in my opinion. Obviously, I could always be wrong, but you can kind of look ahead and see what the future holds when you watch player potentials and compare them to their current attributes. Looking at the next crop of players, obviously, if you need a center, Ralph Sampson is your guy. I think Sampson could go as high as the third pick because he's already polished and ready to go. The reason he might not go is if whoever winds up with the third pick has a couple of bigs already in place and feels like their position of need is more at the guard spot. As far as the guards go, I'll start with the shooting guards. I mentioned that Jeff Malone and Byron Scott both look pretty ready to plug and play. And I know Jeff Malone reads as a yellow-blue, and so some people are probably thinking, Wig, why are you saying he's ready to go? The reason I'm saying he's ready to go is that if you look at his defensive ratings, and again, this is going to be a one-way player, he doesn't have a ton of room for growth anywhere except his offensive ratings, where he's got A's in inside and jump shot, and he's already in the 60s and 70s in those attributes. So when you pick Malone, you're going to get almost instant offense. If I were to compare him to a recent draft pick, he maybe compares somewhat to, Kelly Chirpuka on the Lakers comes to mind. And, you know, or maybe Ronaldo Blackman, but, or Rolando Blackman, sorry. But I feel like it's Chirpuka. And if you look at Chirpuka, when he came into the league, he averaged 20 points right away. So, yes, I think Malone is going to be a defensive liability, but for a team that needs offense and needs it right now, he really is plug and play. Similarly, Byron Scott comes in with slightly lower in his inside rating, but his jump shot rating is already developed. His perimeter defense and his steal are developed. I can see him being the number three overall pick just because he's already a two-way player and has a little bit of room for growth. I think a team that can invest some points into training him will be looking at possibly having a superstar on their hands. Craig Elo, I think, might have the highest ceiling of all of them just due to his size. We know the game does value size. He does have a nice perimeter defensive rating. In terms of potential, he'll need a little time to get there. He's a good all-around player. I think the thing that intrigues me about him is he's got a B rating in handles, even though he's got a current score of 23. So a team could, in theory, grab him and use him with a little bit of paid training as a jumbo point guard eventually. So he's got real versatility. Again, I think he could play small forward even if you needed to with his size. He's certainly got the defensive chops when he fills out into his potentials. Offensively, he's going to be slow to get going. He reminds me a lot of Michael Cooper. So if you can stomach, you know, 12 points per game for the first two or three seasons until his offense blossoms and have a high-impact defensive player, and there are a lot of teams that have good offensive production that could probably afford to roll with that, I think. You know, again, I think I like Elo's ceiling the most. I think he's the most versatile. He's got the best size. But I definitely think Byron Scott is the most ready to go among these guards. And then if you look at the point guards, you've got Derek Harper, Doc Rivers, and Sadale Threat. Doc Rivers reads as the best player currently. He reads as blue. He has good potentials in handles and passing, but he's going to take a few years to get there. Steals, defense. So he's going to be a two-way player. I worry about his ceiling offensively. I don't think he's ever going to be able to be a top-flight offensive player without some paid training, but he could probably be a good distributing point guard, probably a good third or fourth option on your team if you've got two guys for him to feed the ball to. The guy who I am really excited about, and that's because, you know, I'm a defensive guy at heart, I guess, is Derek Harper. I love Harper's defensive ratings, and his handles and passing are very, very high. He's not as well developed. I think the Harper and Doc connection looks a lot like the Sleepy Floyd and Fat Lever connection. Just like Sleepy was very raw in his point guard skills, Derek Harper is raw in his point guard skills. The only thing with Harper is he's a bit raw on his scoring. So a team that is willing to be patient with him is going to see dividends over several years as he grows into an increased role. I've had Derek Harper in other, runs of Sim League, and I always found him to be an excellent, excellent player. So if you have, the number four or five pick, I think, you know, it'll probably be Drexler, Ellis, Scott and Sampson in some order. If you got the number five pick, I'd like to get my fingers on Derek Harper. Hit me up. Last of the three is Sadale Threat. As mentioned, he's the most raw of these prospects. Doesn't have the offensive chops, but just as good eventually on handles, passing, and perimeter defense and steals. So we're seeing a lot of quality defenders at the point guard spot coming in. The only thing I would be worried about is Threat is a little bit undersized compared to some of these other guys. Obviously, Harper is 6'4", Rivers is 6'4". That's probably plenty big. Threat being 6'2" makes him a little bit small. So I think he's probably the last of the blue potential players to go, simply because the things that he does the other guys at point guard do well and maybe do a little better faster than he does. Next up, if we look at the cadre of Green players, let's start by looking through the center options. Thurl Bailey, again, I always thought of him as a small forward, and I think his ratings bear that out. He has a nice block shot rating, but his defensive rebounding and offensive rebounding are a little bit low. I'm kind of surprised at his three-point shooting. I seem to remember him in real life being a perimeter player, but obviously the perimeter defense of 21 now and a D rating means he's probably going to be stuck playing as a big. Maybe he fits more as a power forward, not sure. But, you know, he's a project, and he's going to be, at least to me, he projects as basically an average offensive starter. He's not going to get you 20 points a game, but he'll be solid. Randy Brewer is a little bit more interesting to me in that he is obviously a defender in the mold of, say, an Alton Lister, where he is all defense. He's got an A potential in blocks. He's already got an A rating in blocks, B in post defense, B in both rebounding stats. Not much offensively, but he's 7'3". So this is a guy who I could see at some point being one of the challengers for the league lead in blocks. So this is a guy that you probably want to go after if you already have your offensive force to plug him in and let your offensive guy just go to work. I really see him as a fit on a team like, say, the Bucks, where they've already got McHale doing stuff. I won't say the Warriors because they've already got two monster bigs, but the Bucks seem like the kind of team that would be a great fit, and the Bucks do, with the Clippers pick, potentially have a top 10 pick. So if the choice is between Sadale Threet, say, as the last blue on the board, and the Green guys, I can see the Bucks going for a Randy Brewer. Your last true center on the list is Steve Stepanović. He's more of an offensive threat, with B's in his inside shooting, defensive rebounding, post defense, but not great in blocks. Stepanović, to me, probably projects out as a middling starter. You know, he'll be fine if you don't have anything else at center, but he's not going to be a starting center on a championship squad. At least that's my read on it. At power forward, there's only one, Mark West. I remember Mark West from his time with the Celtics the Suns rather, late in his career. I don't know why the Celtics came out. West is a guy that is very, very raw in terms of his ratings. He does have good defensive rebounding ratings already, but not much offensively. I think the reason you might be excited about him is he's got athleticism, and so if you're willing to put some paid trainings into him, he can develop into a decent player. I think if it were me, I would kind of say the comp might be Steve Johnson on the Bulls. I think he might be able to turn into something like that. Maybe not quite as much of the offensive threat as Johnson is, but West is certainly a serviceable power forward, and with the lack of bigs in this draft, I think he could go early. Rodney McRae is the other power forward on the board. He's another guy that's kind of middling across the board. The thing that makes me a little bit interested in Rodney is he has a B in handles and a C in passing. So he could eventually be developed into kind of an odd point forward. But I just think that based on the fact that all of his ratings are mediocre, he doesn't do anything well, he's going to have a hard time standing out and getting time on a team. So I expect him to go toward the end of the first round, quite honestly. I don't think there's going to be a huge, huge market for him. Moving on to the small forwards, you've got Sidney Green, who is, again, I mentioned before, a lot of times I see guys that are listed as small forwards but really have power forward skill set. That's Green. He's got A's in both rebounding stats and, you know, C's inside a jump shot. So he's a rebounder. I think if somebody were to put some points into developing his post defense. He could really, at 6'9", become a good power forward. Otherwise, he's going to be kind of a niche rebounding small forward for a team that has maybe score first bigs that don't do a lot of rebounding. So he's a role player. He's not a star. At least that's my read on him. Roy Hinson is a guy that I think is another power forward masquerading in a small forward's body. He's got a 6'9 size. So he's got power forward size. He's got a 78 in block shots already. That's probably close to max since he's got a B rating. He's got B ratings in offensive rebounding and defensive rebounding. The difference is he has offense. I can see him probably being the best offensive prospect among the big men in this class not named Ralph Sampson. I think it'll take him a little bit of time to get there, but I really like Roy Hinson as a two-way player, and I think whoever winds up drafting him will have to wait probably until his second training camp for him to make the jump, but he's going to be a guy that you're happy with. In terms of green shooting guards, we've only got one. That's Bob Hansen. Classic case of a guy who's just kind of average everywhere. You know, if you look at his potentials, C's in all of the stuff you want for a guard, couple D's in jump shot and steals, D's in rebounding, and F's in block shots. So he's going to be probably an average to maybe sixth man, average starter to maybe a sixth man starter at best. So I don't see him going very high, especially with all of the other guards in the mix. I think trying to get him is going to be a low priority. Going through the point guards, John Paxson is a guy that most of us remember from the Bulls as kind of a 1.5 guard. You know, usually Jordan was the 2 guard. The Bulls generally had point guards that didn't necessarily handle and pass the ball a lot but could shoot it very well. And Paxson very much looks like that. The one concern I would have about drafting him is his rebounding is absolutely abysmal. You know, has good handles but not a high inside. So it reminds me a lot of Maurice Cheeks, I think would be the comp. Guy with great handles, not a ton of scoring, decent passing. Mo Cheeks is a better passer. But, you know, Paxson is not going to be a star. He's going to be a niche player. Next up, you've got John Sundvold. Sundvold has a lot of quickness, but again, like Paxson, not great as a scorer, not good in terms of rebounding. So he's going to be a negative in the rebounding stats, which hopefully isn't a problem for most teams because your point guard isn't going to be expected to rebound. But again, I think there's just so much work that needs to be done with him that I don't see him being taken very highly. Darryl Walker, on the other hand, is a guy that I think can come in and be a two-way contributor immediately. He has B and A ratings in perimeter defense and steal, and that's not just potential, that's his current ratings. He's already got 56 in his inside and has a B potential there. His handles and passing need some work. So this is a guy, reminds me a lot of Sleepy Floyd. I think he can come in and be a two-way player immediately. It's going to take him some time to grow into a playmaker. But if you played him as an off guard for the first couple of seasons and then moved him to point, you could probably have some success at 6'4". He's a little small for a shooting guard, but not awful. So I would expect to see Walker near the top of the green. So that puts him probably in the very late lottery, first 2 or 3 picks from teams that are in the playoffs. Yeah, I figure he's going to go somewhere between 10 and 13, I would guess. Finally, you've got Mitchell Wiggins, who's another player that's more or less ready to go offensively and defensively. Again, has that BA combo and perimeter defense and steal like so many of these guards. Has Bs across the board, including in his current ratings, in his scoring ratings. So I think, frankly, Wiggins may be the most ready to go out of the gate among all of the point guards, and that includes some of the blue ones. But I think that puts him up in, again, the range of maybe 10 to 13 in terms of where he lands in the draft. So lot of teams will be looking to add point guards this season, I think. Just because, you know, if I look and I go down the list and I'm just, you know, again, sorting by their future ratings, Derek Harper, good point guard. Doc Rivers, good point guard. Sadiel Threet, two seasons away, but will be a good point guard. John Sundvold, decent. Daryl Walker, good point guard. Mitchell Wiggins, good point guard. John Paxson, decent. So you got, by my count, five guys that I think can play right now and two more guys that can grow into their roles. And I think in the league right now, there is a need for point guards. I don't know of a lot of teams that are super happy with their point guard situation. A lot of teams are playing with guys that maybe are distributors but can't score, or scorers that can't distribute. In the Bucks case, for example, they've got Sleepy Floyd, who is a scorer that doesn't distribute. In the Celtics, they've got Maurice Cheeks, who is more of a distributor who doesn't score. So there's a lot of teams I think will be picking up solid point guards this season. So I think the point guard play is really going to be elevated next season, and that's going to be interesting to see as we watch the team leaders, what happens to assists and steals. Generally, if you look at the assist totals, on average in the league, teams are averaging about 25 assists per game on a little less than 50 field goals per game. Let's say 43 field goals per game. So you're seeing assists on 55-60%. I'm just doing the math in my head here of your shots. And the question that I have is, are we about to see an uptick in assists? And with an uptick in assists, will that mean an uptick in field goals made? Will that mean an uptick in field goal percentage? I've always been fascinated to watch that. And the other thing that I've noticed, and I guess you can kind of go back to the archives for this one, and this is one of those things that is always, at least for me anyway, interesting to watch year over year. If you go back to 1980, and again, this is pbsl.ijbl.net/archives/NBPSL, and you look at turnovers per game, the spread was 14.8 to 20.1. And you look at the field goals made per game, the high field goals made per game was 42.9. If we go to 1981 and compare the numbers, the team leaders range in assists, or I'm sorry, in turnovers from 15.6 to 18.4. So there was a marked downturn in turnovers last season from the first season. And the field goals made went up. Your highest average went from 42.6 to 45. And then if you take a look at this season, again, just kind of compare and contrast, assists this season are up to 29 at the high end and 21 at the low end. Turnovers range from 17 to 20. Field goals are up at 46. So we're seeing teams become more efficient over time. Scoring is up, turnovers are down. And I think that's because we're seeing teams starting to focus on eliminating mistakes. And with five good and two average point guards coming in, I think that trend is only going to continue. And so this takes me into one final little tangent on how do you build your team and how do you put your finger to the wind to see what's coming? And I think, you know, the answer is it's very difficult to look deep into the future because we can all think back to players we know in the draft, but what we don't see is how do those players' ratings translate. You know, I mentioned that I was surprised that Thurl Bailey wasn't a perimeter type player because that's how I remember him in real life if you look at his ratings here. So we can't always rely on what we remember from reality to be perfectly mirrored in the fast break engine. But what you can try to do is you can try to look at how trends are going and especially what kind of talent is coming into the league. And this year, there are a lot of players coming in with point guard type skills. Even some of the shooting guards, I mentioned Craig Elo, have high ball handling ability. And if we look at some of the players that have been playing shooting guard throughout the league, that's not always the case. So what we're starting to see is we're starting to see turnovers tightening up. So if you're a team that has been relying on steals, for example, in order to get your extra offense by turning points going the other way, that could become a little bit tougher for you. On the flip side, what that might mean is if you want to keep your steals up, it's time to look at your game plan and start moving your full court press up and maybe starting to pick up players that have high steal ratings to help you run that full court press. Similarly, if you compare eras and you watch rebounding, you might expect rebounding to become more important for a class that has a lot of big men. We really haven't seen one of those yet. I think we've probably got a couple coming. You know, famously, the first two picks in 1984 were Hakeem Olajuwon and Sam Bowie before Michael Jordan. And we know Jordan was an above-average rebounder. Charles Barkley's in that class. He's a good rebounder. So rebounds are probably coming, but at least in the very near term, it's probably time to pick up guys that are ball handlers and passers when there are a lot of them. And then once you see a scarcity in something else, again, you can either try to corner the market or you can try to, you know, pick things up when there are a lot of players of that type available. The last thing I will point out slash think about is just a very quick way. I touched on how do you know where your team is going to finish up. And I think I have mentioned in the past that one of the strongest correlators to wins is point differential. And it's very difficult early in the season because you might have a team that has a lot of games on the road. You might have had a team that's dealing with an injury. So first one or two sims of the season are not good to watch. But generally, point differential after the third sim moves slowly. And that's because you've already, you know, put in a lot of games. Your point differential is not going to be as affected by any one game up or down. And so generally, you know, when I'm looking at point differentials right now, you know, the Warriors have a point differential of 14.8. That's absolutely monstrous. And generally, the rule of thumb that I put in my head, and I guess anybody who's listening to this can kind of watch and see how this turns out as we get to the end of the season, is roughly each 1 point of point differential corresponds to two games over 500. Each negative point of point differential corresponds to one game under 500. And so I'm going to take out an outlier like, say, the Nuggets, who basically sold everything off partway through the season. And so, quite honestly, their point differential is higher than it should be, but they're also in free fall because they've now sold off all their talent. But let's take a team that has been more or less steady throughout the season. And here I'm thinking of someone like, say, the Pistons. And if we look at their point differential right now, it's at negative 4.5. And I'm not picking on the Pistons here. It's just the first team I can think of that hasn't made any major, major moves to their roster. The Bullets have made moves. The Bucks have made moves. Cavaliers made a small move. Pacers have made moves. Knicks have made moves. Celtics have made moves. 76ers, too. So let's look at both of them. 76ers' point differential is currently negative 3.7. Pistons are currently minus 4.5. So if we use my little rule of thumb that I can expect the Pistons are going to end up nine games under 500, what does that look like? Well, 41 and 41 is a 500 record. If you lose one game, now you're 40 and 42. That puts you two games under 500. So they're not going to be exactly nine games under 500. They can't be. But if I were guessing, I would guess they would end up either eight games or 10 games under 500, which would correspond, I believe, to being 36 and 46 or 37 and 45. So for the Pistons, I'm calling that they're going to land on 35 or 36 wins. Let's say 36 wins plus or minus a win. For the 76ers, again, the differential, double it. It goes from 3.7 to 7.4. We're going to round that up to 8. So they should be about 8 games under 500, which means they'll lose 4 games more than 41. So that puts them at 37 wins and 45 losses. Again, there's always room for fluctuation. You know, there's some variance. You have, you know, one or two games. But generally, I find that's a very, very strong way of predicting what's going to happen. And the best place to watch where that could fail, I guess, would be in the Western Conference, where the Jazz are currently at negative half a point. The Lakers and Sonics are at 0.5 and 0.4, respectively. So by that formula, you would expect the Jazz to finish 40 and 42, and the Lakers and Supersonics to both finish 42 and 40. Generally, you're probably pretty happy if they're within three games of that. So right now, based on point differential, I could say the Jazz are going to miss the playoffs. But it doesn't surprise me if they make it, because, again, with a variance of plus three games either way, it's very easy to see, you know, the Jazz winning one or two more games and the Lakers or Supersonics losing one or two more games than the point differential represents, and finishing in a different order than maybe we would expect now. But, you know, based on that, for example, I would think the Clippers would finish the season strong. Now, they may, you know, give up and put in lineups that are not optimal, but, you know, again, you can't control for everything. This is just, you know, doing a basic guesstimate of where teams are going to finish. And so, you know, again, if I'm guessing who the favorites to win the league are, it's the Warriors by a long shot because of their point differential. However, if you were to go back to previous seasons and say, who had the best point differential and did they win the title? The answer is not always yes. If you go back to 1980, when the Nets jumped up to win the title, their differential was only 0.7. The team with the best differential in the league was the Pacers with a 7.6. If you look at 1981, where we had the Nuggets come in to win the title, they had a point differential of 6, which was best in their division. But the Bucks had a 9.3, the Pacers had a 7.8, the Blazers had a 9.9, the Warriors had a 6.1, Suns 6.7. So they weren't the best point differential team. The team with the best point differential does not always win the championship, but it's probably the team that should be favored to win the championship. So when we take a look at this season, again, based on that alone, it's a simplistic idea, I know, but I definitely think right now the Warriors are your runaway favorites just because their point differential is so much bigger than everybody else. The other thing to notice is you can see the tanking, in that you can see that every year the point differentials are getting more and more pronounced. I think the hope would be once we round the corner of 1984 and fewer teams are trying to tank, and the teams that went all in now are starting to run into issues keeping everybody due to cap concerns, we'll see that flatten back out. In general, I think, and this is just my opinion, it's healthy when you have point differentials somewhere between 7 and negative 7 across the league. The best team is a 7, the worst team is a negative 7. It gets unhealthy once teams start getting into the 10s, and you know, obviously we're already there with the Warriors. No, not yelling at the Warriors or that it's a problem if it's that way for one season. If we're four seasons from now and the Warriors have won four straight titles and they're still at, you know, plus 15 points a game, at that point it's probably not great for the competitive health of the league, because you always want there to be the blue shell effect for Mario Kart, where whoever's in the back has the ability to get back into it. I know there's been a lot of talk about people saying tanking is fine, tanking is not fine, how are we going to tell you to run your team, I think it will be interesting to see after next season, once Michael Jordan, Hakeem Olajuwon, Charles Barkley, some of these superstars are introduced to the league, and they're going to go to bad teams because teams are tanking for them. In order to tank, it means you had to rip out your roster. If you were a team that won, let's say, 15 games the previous season, you had Michael Jordan, I don't think you're going to get to 50 games. I think you might be able to get to 30 games, and it's going to take adding more pieces. You know, we talk about Magic and Moses being complete game changers, but again, these guys came into the league thanks to the creation draft more or less fully formed. And all of the guys that we've been seeing lately are three, four, five seasons away. I can't imagine Olajuwon and Jordan are going to be much different. They're not going to come in at the peak of their powers. They're going to come in with three or four seasons before they really get their feet under them. So those of you that are playing the long game, keep playing the long game. Just realize you're going to need to be patient. That's all I've got for this time. I guess next time we're probably scheduled for a playoff preview. This has been Chat with a Cat. Again, if you have ideas, things you'd like to hear, things you'd like to see, always interested in ideas, send them my way.